Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field. I'm your host, Liseli Sitali, and today I've got a guest who I can only describe as someone who is going to take us on a really good educational journey, the kind of journey that will challenge you, but I also hope inspire you, because she definitely does both those things for me. It's the wonderful Hayley Bennett. Hello, Hayley. How are you doing?
Oh, Liseli, you're so cute. Thank you. And hi, I'm doing well.
Good. Great to have you here. So as I mentioned there, I'm saying this podcast is going to be a little bit of a come to Jesus moment for people, but in a good way. And the reason I've said that is because you're working in an area of work that I personally have had to do a lot of work in to learn and also educate myself. But it's something that I find incredibly interesting, which is that you work as a diversity and inclusion consultant and with a particular focus on working within the sports industry, which, of course, does not do well in these two areas in a lot of different ways, but of course had to confront the reality of what that means last year. So I would love to take some time later on to deep dive into that and what a day-to-day work for that looks like. But before we do that, I'd love to really understand and get an idea of your relationship with sport and why you love it so much. So I'd like to start off by talking to you about what inspired you to get into sport. What was that moment that made you fall in love with football in particular? Because that's your domain, right? So what, do you have an early sporting memory or an experience that really sort of galvanized that love in you?
Yeah, I do actually. And it's interesting because I don't really get a chance to talk about this. I feel a bit embarrassed because I came to sport a little bit late.
Okay. No shame. It's never too late. It's never too late. I always tell people
it's never too late. I completely agree. But I think, when I was growing up, I wasn't sporty really, but I did rhythmic gymnastics.
Oh, right. Awesome.
It was really, really good. And we used to go to a lot of competitions. And she competed at like British level as well.
Yeah.
So I didn't really take too much interest in other sports. Football has always been part of my life. It's always been something that like my family have come together and watched. My dad's really into football. One of my earliest memories is my dad talking to me about Arsenal players when he was giving me a bath when I must have been really small.
Early indoctrination. I love it.
But it was actually, I can remember the moment, it was in the 2006 World Cup that I became really interested in football. I went to an all-girls school.
Yeah.
And there were a few girls who were interested in football. And we just all got really into it. Like there's a few people in my class who were following it. I think a lot of schools in the UK do stuff when the World Cup's on, like, look at this international theme or wear a shirt or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think something like that had taken place. And then I just got really hooked. I remember I watched like as many games in the tournament as I could. I became really obsessed with following the different teams and the players. And then I should say this is a men's World Cup.
Yeah.
And then at this point, I had no idea women played football. I'm not even exaggerating when I say that.
Yeah.
And then basically, I just got hooked and I started really getting into Arsenal. It was the year that Arsenal moved to the Emirates.
Yeah.
And my mum was really supportive. Like, she managed to get us a few tickets to go. I remember going to my first game. And it was just a transformational experience for me. And I've never been the same since.
Being an Arsenal fan changes you. It's true.
I'm still waiting for our glorious experience.
Oh, gosh. You came in at the wrong time, Hayley. I'm sorry about that.
I think that's cursed us. But, and I think I just came more aware of football and then obviously women's football later on because there just wasn't over the visibility of women's football at that time.
Yeah, no, totally.
So it's taken me a bit longer to get as hooked on women's sport and women's football in particular.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a true reality for a lot of people about football and in particular women's football, the fact that there wasn't enough visibility and representation from an early age when you got into football. As you say, the way in for everybody, most people I speak to, it has been men's football because it's been so well supported and publicized. And as you say, also integrated into schools, even if there wasn't that, let's say, that hunger and appetite normally in the curriculum. But when a men's World Cup happens, it seems to take on a cultural resonance that women's sport doesn't. And I think that's so important for us as well in order to change the level of visibility for women's sport. Integrating it and normalizing it into everyday instances is such a key step. And later on, I want to talk to you about a project you're doing that aims to do that around Just Watch Me Play, which is a film short that you've produced around a little girl and her love for the game. So I think, you know, those kind of projects are so important to have and to make more commonplace.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and obviously in terms of representation and the importance of visibility and particularly different voices and identities, that's something that's really couched in your everyday work, right? That you've always done, starting off in your journey. So I wanted you to sort of take us back to how did you get to this point through tracking through your career, and what is it that thing that sort of inspired you to specifically work in this area? Because one thing I have to say for everybody, why I was saying this is going to be a little bit of a challenging episode was, and at least it is for me to think about, is that this area of work and what it means and its significance, probably if I'm really 100% honest with you, I didn't really get really cognizant of in terms of its full breadth until about 18 months ago. I would say before that, I was really fixed around gender equality and the representation because as you, I was very aware of the little opportunities for female athletes because I grew up loving and watching tennis. And so when the Williams sisters broke on the scene, it was kind of utopia for me. Before then, I really only had, let's say, tennis players who were out of the norm. I loved them, you know, like Andre Agassi, who really like kind of bucked the norm and authority. And I think what drove that inside me, if I think back to it, was the fact that they were anti-establishment and they looked different and were more relatable than, you know, the sort of grass court sort of whiter than white players like Pete Sampras, etc., who were great talents, don't get me wrong, but it was harder to lean into them. And I think one of the areas that I'm really interested in finding out for you is what has that journey been like? Because you've been doing this for a long time. And then obviously in the last 12 months, since the murder of George Floyd in particular, the rest of the world seems to have woken up to the value of this work and trying to integrate it. So how have you found that journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a journey. That's probably the way I would describe it.
Yeah,
I've always done this work. It's all I've ever known. And like my first job was an intern at Kick It Out. So I've been really exposed to inequality, just outright discrimination and abuse from, my whole adult life, really. I was always really passionate about inclusion issues and social justice when I was at school. I think back and I don't understand how I used to do this, but I used to go to like conferences, physical events and things like that when I was at school. My sister would bring me along to them. I've always been an activist.
Yeah.
And I ended up going to university studying politics with this idea I was going to change the world. And I got there and it definitely was not like in the plans. So I decided it's going to have to be through the career choice I make. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I look back and I think I was really fortunate to be in a position where a role came up and I was given the opportunity, because at the time when I was offered the internship, which was unpaid, which is probably like a taboo now, but I took it because I had actually applied for over 250 jobs at uni and I hadn't got anywhere of any of them. And I needed to make money, don't get me wrong, but I was really nervous about like where my career was going to take me because I had no idea. My parents didn't go to university. I had this idea that when I went to uni, I was going to get a certificate and I was just going to get a top job. And obviously that's not the reality.
Yeah.
So I was just fortunate that I saw I think I was going to pass it on to somebody else. And then I saw that they were offering an internship and I thought, wow, this is like really up my street.
Yeah.
Anti-racism. Well, I thought it was anti-racism. Obviously, Kick It Out cover all forms of discrimination.
Yeah.
But anti-racism and football, my two like biggest passions in life, and it was just a match made in heaven. Didn't think I was going to get anywhere. And it was funny. I look back because I think there was a delay with them sifting through the applications for some reason or another. So I didn't hear for quite a long time. So I just assumed it was a write-off and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then they called me for an interview and I was just so shocked. I remember I nearly didn't actually go to the interview because I was so nervous.
Well, I was going to say, what made you not want to go to the interview? Let's talk about that because I think it's important to visit that.
I think at the time I wasn't in the best place, like mentally. I think applying to all those jobs.
Soul destroying, right?
Yeah, it really was. And being like completely out of my comfort zone at uni and just feeling like I wasn't good enough. my mental health had taken a proper battering, to be honest. And I really had to like grapple with that and like force myself to get on. I remember getting on the tube, I was on the Metropolitan line, and I nearly just turned back as well. It was really hard, but I was fine in the end. And that's, do you know what though? I feel like that's like a metaphor of my life, because people think I'm really confident and I just do what I want. But honestly, I tend to have to like really psych myself up to do things. And whenever I do it, I'm fine. I just worry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have this theory that actually some of the most successful people who work in roles that involve them having to do work that's difficult and really pushes themselves out of their comfort zones are actually tend to be more introverts than extroverts. Mm. And the reason why I say that is I say it because, and you can, like, it would be interesting to hear your perspective on this. I think it happens because you're so well rehearsed at what that level of discomfort and risk feels like, because it's your everyday being. Whereas to extroverts, actually, when it comes to levels of discomfort, they are actually, and I say this being an extrovert, I actually hesitate a lot more. And the reason I hesitate a lot more than people would think is because I'm so conscious about how it will be received. But I think if you're always working from a place where it's already taken enough energy and time to get out, everything else afterwards is just you take it as it comes. Is that something you recognize in yourself?
I can relate to that. Yeah, I think so. And I think I'm quite a reflective person. I always have been. Mm-hmm. And that definitely is a bonus for me in this work. And I think because I've flourished in this pandemic, maybe I am an introvert after all.
No, definitely. I think a lot of people who are introverts have flourished. And as I said, I think the reason for that is that you're just better versed in how to adapt and manage with that discomfort and that ambiguity, because in a lot of ways you have to sort of always pivot and change and adapt your behaviors and communication styles to fit that, right? Because it's expected of you, particularly in the job that you do, that you would just be outgoing and you wouldn't suffer from those moments of confidence, a crisis of confidence, which of course was completely understandable given what you went through. And I just want to sort of take the track back to two things. First, I want to understand, what is it that happened in your upbringing that just gave you this inherent sense of wanting to pursue this particular line of work? And then the other thing I want to also revisit is just, how did you then get the confidence to stay on that Metropolitan line to go to the interview? I think those things would just be really interesting to explore with you if we can.
Maybe they're a bit linked, actually, because I've grown up, I'm a mixed race. My mum's white, my dad's black from St. Lucia. And we lived in quite a white area when I was younger. Yeah. And I experienced racism from quite a young age. And at the time, it was just part of my life. I didn't really, I would say I didn't take notice of it, but obviously I did, because I can recall it really, really clearly now. And obviously now I do this work, and the last 12 months everyone can reflect on their experiences. But I think because I was from a family that was like multiracial, I'm always confident and comfortable having conversations about race and difference from a young age. Mm-hmm. And I had to put up a lot of comments in my I mean, don't get me wrong, I was probably really rude to some people, but my position has always been like educational, and I have tried to do that with friends or like people that I've met along the way. So I think it's just something that comes really natural to me. And yeah, just with like embracing all of my intersecting identities as well. So not just in particular race, but I would say that that's probably, my first experience of racing was when I was in school and I was, I think, 5 years old in the playground. Mm-hmm. So it's something I was just a lot more used to. Yeah. But I love my parents a lot, because honestly, I couldn't ask for anyone better to I guess get me to the place where I am now, because my mom, she does not put up with anything. Like, she always tells me to speak my mind. She always defend me. She always tell me to like go after what I want. And my dad's quite similar. Like, something he always says to me is like, you're a leader, not a follower. And he had quite a lot of high expectations of me. So he would never really allow for me to shrink myself or to, you know, limit my where I am in life. Even now, he's a bit preachy. I know he'll listen to it, so I don't mean it in a bad way.
I love it.
But he does Mr. really
Bennett,
encourage
we love that you pushed her, because if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have her where she is. So thank you, sir.
Yeah, he wasn't.
I'm going to give him a shout out.
I would say, like, both of them, they were really, like, I would say they weren't pushy. They were actually really supportive. And I think the fact that they weren't pushy was a good thing. Yeah, because they never said, oh, Hayley, you need to go off and make loads of money, or Hayley, you need to do this. It was literally just supporting any idea, no matter how ridiculous or like, interesting it was at the time. They would always just, like, be 100% behind me, and they left it down to me for what I wanted to do, which has been really good because I didn't have a plan. And, you know, that's something I would say to people who are looking to, you know, think about where they want their careers to take them. You honestly don't need a plan. Like, everyone says you have to have it all planned out, but you really don't. Especially a lot of parents put pressure on their kids to have a plan. Mm. But I think nowadays we do need to, like, you used the word, Lizelle, pivot a second ago. And that's really sort of what I've been doing throughout my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's such a valuable lesson there that your parents taught you from the first sort of instance, helping you to make sure you found your voice and making sure that you were really rooted in your belief of your potential. Because I think those are two key things that will actually catapult someone to much more levels of success than anything else, because what you're allowing them to do is find the space and time to find what it is that they're passionate about and what it is they're good at, so they can then use that as you've brilliantly done, as a way in to then really believing in themselves. And I think probably, do you think that is why you stayed on that metropolitan line? Because somewhere within you, all those sort of mantras, as you'd call them, preachiness from your dad, in those moments you were able to draw upon them and just say, look, I am doubting that I'm good enough, but I am, because I'm meant to lead. And because I'm meant to lead, I need to go and do this to make sure I am giving myself the best shot. Do you think somewhere within that is what kept you on that tube line?
Yeah, and I think just the belief that everything will work out in the end, because it always has and it always does. So I definitely agree with that. And I remember getting there, the interview was super relaxed. They were really nice to me. They were really impressed by me. And, you know, the rest is history. So it just goes to show you that there was no need for me to ever... Whenever I spoke to the person who hired me the other day about it, and he was just like, I don't know why you ever doubted yourself. But it's funny to look back on now. And I think I was in a lucky position because my dad works for the Tube, so I had like free travel. I was able to go to do an internship.
Yeah, so I was going to say, that's such a big cost barrier. I was going to say that's such a big cost barrier as well, because, as you say, taking unpaid internships is another reason why, again, in sport and in other industries, we haven't had a good broad representation, particularly of people from low socioeconomic sort of backgrounds, because you can't afford to take a job that doesn't pay you, because you've got to support your family, you've got to support yourself. You don't have that luxury of having a family or a social circle, let's say, of support that can, you know, meet your living costs whilst you get that experience. And for you, the form there was your dad. You know, he's worked through Transport for London, through being able to actually give you the means to physically get to work, because people also forget that in itself can be a real barrier for people to enter industries.
Yeah, it just made such a difference, and I made the most of it when I was there, and they offered me a like part-time job for the rest of my time at uni. So it wasn't like I was working unpaid for a long time, it was supposed to be only temporarily. And then I just really progressed from intern to like assistant, and then I was running the education program for a couple of years before I left and wanted to expand from, I guess, doing this kind of work around diversity and inclusion and anti-discrimination work in football. My plan actually was to learn from outside of football and see what other sectors were doing.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to like find all the answers and then go back to football and like fix everything. But I've actually just really enjoyed working in like other settings. And now obviously because I work for myself, I've just got the freedom to do a bit of both.
Yeah, no, definitely. And of course, from there, you then obviously then went to Kick It Out, right? That was your sort of first sports career entry point.
Yeah. So I was at Kick It Out for 5 years, and then I left in 2017 to go and work at Business in the Community. It's like a responsible business charity. It works with a load of different organisations. And then I worked in a consultancy for a bit, and then I set up on my own as a consultant. So I've been working as like a consultant for about 5 years now.
Yeah. And how did you find that transition? Because obviously, you know, we talked there about the uncertainty and security that comes from, you know, paid internships and that entry level. But there's also the same challenge that, right, that comes from working for yourself. So you move from, a shoe-in job that you've got, you know, when I say shoe-in, the job security element, right? You've got the salary coming in, you know, when it's coming in, you have the stability. Whereas to when you go and you branch out on your own, there's that risk that you take that sometimes you will have the work and other times you won't. Where did you find the resolve in yourself to go for that? Because there's a lot of people who are, you know, on that journey at the moment because of how the job market has changed in the last 12 months. So what sort of things did you learn from that experience that you'd love to pass on?
Do you know what? Honestly, only do it if you can afford to do it, because I didn't know that, how it would work. I was quite brave, a decision I made.
Absolutely.
I made a decision to do it I just dug really deep in my values. I realized that, you know, this wasn't working for me. I realized I could make a bigger impact if I worked for myself, and I needed that control. Mm-hmm. So I sort of like let that outweigh my desire to, I guess, have nice things. Like, I was doing well. I was on a good salary. I was on a salary that I would only ever dreamed of.
Yeah.
But it's interesting now I look back, because one of the things that used to keep me up at night was literally like, Hayley, how are you going to pay your rent? Mm. Hayley, what's going to happen if something happens to someone in your family? You won't be able to help them. And I used to worry about that. And then just one moment just switched in me, and I was like, actually, Hayley, what if you do even better than you're doing? Make more money, and you make, you know, more impact, and you have like a better work-life balance. And I just started changing my perspective and thought, well, that's what I'm going to aspire to do.
I've
achieved that. I'm making more money than I was making. I've got like much better quality of life. I'm working with even more amazing organizations. So sometimes we hold ourselves back and we let fear hold us back. And I say that, obviously that sounds like it was super straightforward. I was panicking. But I think for anyone who, even if you've got a little bit of money set aside for savings, if it doesn't work out, you can always find a full-time job again. But just do everything you can for a couple months to get yourself in a good position and make adjustments. Like, I wasn't spending a lot of money. I was making sure that I was maximizing every opportunity, and that's all you really need to do. It is scary, but your idea, your passion will push you through, and it's worth it. I think especially for women, sometimes we feel like a burden of a lot of responsibilities, and that can hold us back.
Yeah, no, I completely identify with that, and I completely agree with you, having taken the decision to step away from my own full-time job because it didn't align with my personal values and how I was starting to feel I wanted to show up and be as a person, both professionally and personally. And I think what you say there about that moment of, and it always reminds me of like one of my favorite quotes, and my friends and family who are listening will be like, oh God, here she goes again. I always say to them, like, in the moments when I find things really difficult, I always remember a really profound quote I heard from Nelson Mandela, which was, may your choices reflect your hopes, not your fears.
Yeah.
And whenever things get super hard and I feel fearful, I'm always like, okay, wait, why am I making a decision where I'm driven by everything potentially going wrong instead of being hopeful and intentional about making sure that it goes well? As you say, because of the freeing capacity that comes from that versus staying safe and small, right? And I put safe in inverted commas because it's a perceived level of safety, but it's not. It's actually kind of putting yourself in a place where you compromise yourself and you compromise what you stand for. And through doing that, you do yourself more long-term harm than the short-term pain that would come from actually moving out of that comfort zone and going to do something that actually, yes, at first it's like a jump off the cliff moment, but you know, the potential for where you can land and land so much better like you have, that should be your driver.
Yeah, we can't let fear hold us back. And I think fear is natural. Some fear we need. It's a survival instinct. But I think
definitely
in our careers and as people who are trailblazers and wanting to have a, you know, bigger impact on the world, we definitely have to like make hope-based decisions. I love that quote from Nelson Mandela. It's a good one. That's what I've been trying to do. I mean, I don't always practice what I preach, but even now, like, I turn down a lot of work because if it doesn't align to what I want to do, or if I don't feel like I'm the best person for it, I'm comfortable making that decision, and I feel like the universe always gives you something back.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, we have to trust that as well.
Yeah, you get out what you put in, right? And I just want to spend some time now to talk about the kind of work you do. And first of all, I'm going to start with a super obvious question to people. And the reason I'm going to ask you this is because I think in the last sort of 12 months, at least for me, in my sphere, in my circles of work and relatives and friends and family, everybody has been hearing the terms diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm. diversity, equity and inclusion, diversity, equality and inclusion, and on all the variations, right? But I wanted just you to take some time for everybody, because I think this is so important, to explain actually what that work means and why in particular there's so many variations, let's say, on the theme in terms of how it's titled. Because I think that's important for people to understand before we then go into the bones of the type of work that you're actually doing in this space.
Oh, such a good question. So I think this, you're very right. Like, people don't understand what the things actually mean, and the fact that they're terms that actually mean something that's very different.
Yeah. And so, I think people are embarrassed to ask as well, right?
Yeah.
That's the one thing I've witnessed definitely in circles where I've been trying to help and trying to also improve myself and my understanding. People feel embarrassed to ask.
Yeah, I think people think like diversity works. They just think that I'm brought in to help basically get more black and brown people in organisations. And I think some people, organisations think that's what it is as well, which isn't it at all. So in terms of like, what my sort of day-to-day job is, I actually normally emphasise like the equity in the work that I do, mm-hmm. because equity is a process. So it's an approach that we have to take to make sure that everybody has the same, well, has access to the same opportunities. Mm. And, you know, equity, I think especially in a sports context, is very much neglected, because equity as a concept like allows us to remember that there's advantages or power, for, you know, being frank, that exists for some, and there are barriers and, you know, lack of power that exists for others. And that just recognise that, you know, to use a sporting analogy, we're not all from, you know, the same place in the starting line. You know, we've got, we're all coming at, you know, life from a different perspective.
Yeah.
So equity work is more about, you know, acknowledging this first and foremost, but working to, redress the issues that will cause. So most of my work actually with organisations is looking at how they function, mm-hmm. their processes, their policies, what that actually looks like in practice, the behaviours that exist within their organisation, to try and, you know, remove those barriers.
Yeah.
Which people don't always want to do, because most of the time it's working quite well for a lot of people, which is why I think particularly in sport, we don't see this talk about equity, whereas like diversity is more about representation mm-hmm. and increasing visibility of people from marginalized groups and having them around the table. I think in sport, this tends to look like just hiring a few different people, but mm-hmm. not really allowing them to have a true authentic voice and not mm-hmm. allowing them to take up their own space. We often are inviting people to sit at tables which were never designed for them.
Yes.
And they're not, you know, given the opportunity and the platform to speak authentically. And then there's like this whole thing around inclusion, around which is more about the culture. Mm-hmm. It's more about behaviours around how people act. It's making sure that people, once we remove these barriers, are thriving, can be themselves, are in an environment which is conducive to, you know, their success. So there's a lot to it, and you know what it looks like in practice is strategy work, you know, coaching, working with leaders to get them to understand their role in facilitating this, helping with challenges that might come up, training workshops where people are doing a little bit of learning and unlearning, and just engaging people with the process. Because I think one of the misconceptions with this work, you mentioned how it's become quite popular over the past 2 months, is that people get this and people get that it's important, so we all need to do it. Mm-hmm. The reality is, on the ground, people don't get why this matters to them, why this is important to their organisation. So, so much of my job is like doing that convincing part.
Yes.
And getting people to understand what their role is, especially in sport. It's not coherent. It's not like clear why we're doing this. It's just a nice thing to do. But actually, we know that there's so many benefits to making this happen.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I want to just go through a few things that you say. So thank you for giving that really helpful overview. And I think putting it in those really simple layman terms helps people to understand a little bit more about that access to opportunities that everyone is getting, right? And I think that's the bit that people forget. And I think it's so important. And I think the reason why people forget it or conveniently decide to forget it and overlook it, and in particular, as you say, why they choose not to focus on equities, in order to be able to give everybody the same equal opportunities, someone has to give up their power and their privilege, or the advantage, whichever way you want to put it. So I think one of the things that happens in industries that exist based on relationships and referrals, rather than, let's say, policies that are, you know, let's say fair and transparent and have that level of rigor in them, is that all those things have to be given up. And a lot of people have assumed their position and their status and their living based on actually benefiting from those inequitable systems. And I personally, when I look at it, not being an expert like you, I think that actually is the biggest barrier for us, particularly in the sports industry, that that's what holds us back, that people are so unwilling to give those things up because they're scared of what it might mean for their new place in the new order. Is that something you've found in the work you've been doing with people, or is it something that I'm just paranoid about?
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. And the thing is, the system is working for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So they think if it's not broken, don't fix it. I mean, I don't even want to go down this route, but I'm going to just very briefly bring up the report that came out from Number 10.
I do have a question for you. So just to before we go into it, just because I'm conscious, I've been lucky enough to build a bit of an international audience. So Hayley and I are based in the UK, as you guys know, and recently, there was a commissioned report done by the UK government from a committee called the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities. And it was headed up by Dr. Tony Sewell, who was an advisor to the government, in order to look into whether or not there actually was here an issue with race and racism, and whether or not those things were actually impacting the economic, social, economic development opportunities and education for people from minority ethnic backgrounds. And the report concluded, and Hayley, I hope you're okay. I don't want to trigger anybody.
No, I'm okay.
The report concluded that the UK no longer has a system that is rigged against people from ethnic minorities, and that in fact it should be, and I quote, a model for the rest of Europe and possibly the world. This was one of the headlines from the executive summary of the report. So with that context, I would now like to invite you to talk through that, because that obviously, seeing that report go out yesterday, because, you know, we're now Thursday and it came out on Wednesday, the 31st of March. How does that make you feel in the particular practice that you're in? Because does it feel like, a few people I've heard who work in your field have said, it felt like we take 40 steps forward last year when people even started to talk about this and started to be more conscious about what they could do in terms of creating better equitable systems. But now they have a government certified report that says, actually, this problem doesn't exist. And I believe the particular phrase that Tony Sewell used constantly was that people have kind of decided that there's institutional racism, but he said that actually institutional racism is sometimes wrongly applied. And I believe mm-hmm. he said he felt it was a sort of catch-all phrase for microaggressions or acts of racial abuse. How do you square all of that? How do you digest that and still get people to understand what they need to do in order to increase their efforts and their change management? Because that's what you're doing, right? It's a business change management that you're going in to talk to them around, when the government effectively saying that this problem doesn't exist. Actually, you're doing all right. Carry on.
Yeah, it's really hard. But I think, honestly, the organizations that I'm lucky to work with and the organizations that approach me know that I kind of know what I'm talking about, and they don't want a quick fix. So yeah. I think there are always people within organisations that you need to convince, and people who maybe get it on a surface level but don't dig deeper, which makes yeah. you know, these kind of reports make it harder. But there is a few like connotations to this report that have been, you know, pervasive throughout, you know, the past decade really in mm-hmm. business and in sport, which is actually it's black and brown people, you're the problem. You know, it's not society, it's not racism. And it goes back to what we were just saying about how the system works for a lot of people. They just think, well, you're just not good enough. You know, it's about the best person for the job. And how many times do we hear that in sport, like especially with management positions? So it's tiring, but I think honestly, but working for Kick It Out, when, as you can probably imagine, it's a very small team, racism was happening, you know, on the pitch very frequently. We would have a media flurry of interest, similar to what, you know, on a smaller scale, similar to what happened, you know, last May and June with Black Lives Matter. But it would happen on smaller scale in really regular intervals. Everybody would be on it, it'd be a hot topic, and then it would get, you know, dropped, or somebody who'd come out and supported Kick It Out and said a lot of great things would go on to make a huge mistake, and or maybe not even a mistake. And the attraction would just go again.
Yeah.
So I'm just used to be honest, like my body and my mind has adjusted to this little bit of progress and attention and us going backwards. And it's just recognizing equity actually is a good, you know, as a term, it allows for that. It tells us this is something that we need to always maintain. We're not striving towards like an outcome. Equity is a practice that we need to continually go through. Because until we remove all the barriers, and they will, you know, manifest in different ways and evolve, we are going to continue to face issues. So I think I've just got a high level of tolerance for it because of the work I've done in football.
So
I feel for people who don't, because honestly, it is. But I was demotivated for about an hour yesterday, and then I just got up and I worked with some great people and I was fine again.
That's really encouraging to hear, because as I said, you're on the front lines. And just so I can clarify for people, the organization you worked for, Kick It Out, we've mentioned it a few times, but it's English football's equality and inclusion organization. They support professional clubs as well as grassroots, I believe, right?
In helping
to empower the leaders within those organizations, as well as people who play the game and coach the game, to better understand the role in which diversity and inclusion should play in making the game as inclusive for everyone as possible. Is that, would you say that's a fair summary of what Kick It Out do?
I think that's quite fair, because people think it's just about responding to racist incidents, which is a lot more than that.
A lot more than that, yeah. And as you said, the conditioning that you get when you have such an uphill battle, particularly in a game like football, which is a global game, a game that almost every country you go to, people love and is the number one sport, apart from, you know, one or two countries. But what it has also brought with it, football, I think, is sadly a culture of intolerance and a culture that reflects actually sometimes some of the less than desirable parts of our society. And when you look at that and you're in that environment and you're working within it, knowing the power that football has to unite and break down barriers, but also the power, sadly, that it also has to keep those barriers up and actually to reinforce some elements of negativity. How do you balance that? How do you straddle that world? Because that must have been quite hard to get used to, because you said you're used to it now and you're better able to manage it, particularly when, you know, completely, and I'm just going to be frank, stupid, ill-placed reports like this that have been deliberately designed to be divisive and dismissive of people's lived experience on purpose. We'll come to that in a different time, but not now. But how did you learn that? Because in the time, it must have been quite difficult, right? Because it's breaking down a few ideals for you, because you said it was a dream for you to go and work in that space because it was your two areas of passion. But when you saw those instances, as you talked about, where they'd be heightened interest and intent, and then it would just suddenly go away with the media attention mostly going away from it, right? If we're frank, how did you deal with that in the initial days when you were first met with it?
I think from the beginning, I just had a high level of resilience, and there was like a good, you know, I had some really great friends I was working with and people not in that team who I saw as colleagues who just have a support network. But I think, to be honest, you do need a lot of resilience to do this kind of work. Like I have a lot of like younger people saying to me, oh, I'm just graduating, I want to do diversity work, I'm really passionate. Passion is not enough, but passion and your like connecting to your purpose, that helps you push through when there are tough times, because you realize that there's so much work to do. Not only that actually I'm the person who's placed to help do this. And there's been times when I've felt, you know, actually wouldn't it be so nice if I didn't have to wake up every day and explain to people about how bad things are. But I think, honestly, I do this not just because I enjoy it and I think it's important, but, you know, this is where my confidence will come through. I know I'm good at it. And mm-hmm. I see a lot of people who are not. And yeah. I feel like I do kind of have a role to make a difference. And that will help motivate me. And it's whenever things like this happened, it does motivate me to just keep working harder.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. And I think probably a lot of that resilience, do you feel like that came from the fact that you had in some ways that difficulty that you talked about since you were 5 years old of facing prejudice and discrimination and racism? So somehow you have managed through your lived experience to be able to build those tools that then make you successful in a professional space.
Yeah, 100%. And just knowing that this is reality. And I'm an idealist to a point that I do have a vision for mm-hmm. which is a lot fairer. But I know from mm-hmm. my lived experience and having empathy with other people that this is not, you know, the current reality. So, yeah, that and just being really motivated, having great people, great mentors, great mm-hmm. support system. It just allows me to flourish even when it is hard. So it's not all me. I do have a great group of people around me.
No, that's awesome. But I think often the group of people you're with is a reflection of you. So I do think it is something to do with you. I will contest that point slightly. But yeah, and whilst we're in the subject of talking about reflections of learnings and circles and people you benefit from, I want to just take some time now because I'm always so interested when I meet people who are incredibly, I think you're somebody I would describe as having a really high level of emotional intelligence and being introspective. I always like to have this section of the podcast with people like you because I like to understand if you were to sort of look back at the life defining sort of or career defining moments, let's call them both, that have kind of shaped you and your approach to your work, but also your love of football and how you use it to connect people. What sort of three kind of top key moments? They can be more than that if they have been, because I imagine you've accomplished so much, they should be. That would you say have you got the most valuable learnings from that you think are helpful for other people who want to follow in your footsteps?
Ooh, so the one that comes to mind straight away is one of my favorite projects I've worked on. And probably the thing I'm most proud of is that when I was at Kick It Out and the 2 years before I left, I set up basically a young ambassadors program. Yeah. And I brought together a really like diverse, energetic, just amazing group of young people from ages 16 to I think they were 22.
Great.
Who were there to represent young people's voices and help me with the work I was doing around education.
Yeah.
And the reason why, you know, I say that is because they still have had like such a huge impact on my life. They gave That's me so great. Much life then, and now Aww. I'm still in touch with them all. And they were just an amazing group of people. They were all so different. No one knew each other. And we just brought them together to create such an amazing team. And their outlook on things just really inspired me. And they've all gone on to do just such amazing things, whether that's just personally, following their passions. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are working in football in professional clubs. That's you know, awesome. my desire is for them to just like supersede me and do some amazing things, and hopefully they'll hire me one day. But they
high
are just...
high bar you've set for them, which I love. You are definitely your father's daughter.
Yeah, but they didn't even need it. Like they were just already amazing, and we did some great things together. Like really grassroots things. Like I remember a couple of us went to Lincolnshire on a really windy day. It was freezing. To, like talk to young people there who, you know, don't grow up around people who look like us.
Yeah.
We had a meeting with the chair of the FA where I actually just let them speak and air their voice, their concerns and their aspirations and their desire for what the FA should be doing to help. Yeah, I guess diverse young people basically.
And
it was just really wholesome.
And make them feel included and have ownership of the game, right? You know, not just to be sideline spectators. I think that's so important to give those opportunities. So a really, really fitting project for you as well, particularly because you're somebody I've always seen as creating spaces and opportunities for people to be their full selves and to realize their potential in that. And when I first came across you was actually through another project, and I don't know if I hope I'm not stealing your thunder, but that really showed me that was such great opportunity that you use your platform to help other people develop their own voice is your Nutmegs, which is your football community for women of color and non-binary people of color. I felt that that was so refreshing and so different, and also another really great opportunity for people to get empowered through the game of football. So do you want to talk a little bit about what motivated that project? Was it as a result of the learning you got from this one that you did at Kick It Out, or was it just coincidental?
Yeah, and literally one of the young people is actually the person I co-founded it with. So it's fitting that you mentioned it, actually.
So it is. They are linked. That's awesome.
Yeah, they are linked. So Amara, who was one of the most sort of shyest young people, we built a really good connection, actually, and she's not shy at all now. Like, she's out.
See, my introvert theory is starting to stack up now. You're providing me with good empirical evidence. Love it.
Yeah, so she's like a South Asian Muslim girl, lives in the north.
Yeah,
has like quite a similar experience to me, but also obviously very different. And we just, you know, always stayed in touch, talked about things. One of the things that I have always noticed is that I've been fortunate to meet a lot of friends through football. Even when I was younger and I was into football in my teenage years, I used to use forums a lot. I don't know if people listening used to go on football forums.
I did.
Sorry if I was spamming you with comments. Probably was me.
So good.
But I've always felt that, and I've always connected through football, but I always used to watch football on my own or with like my parents.
Yeah.
And it's the same for like Amara, she plays a lot of football as well. And we just there was actually something, I won't even go into detail of it because it's kind of like negative, but there was a group on Twitter, I didn't know anything about them at the time, which is why I'm not going to go into it, because I don't want to disrespect them. I hadn't heard of them.
Yeah.
But they were basically representing women fans, and they were all white pretty much. And I just thought, you know, this isn't actually reflective of the fans that I know. And we just had like a bit of a Twitter exchange about it, me and Amara, and we thought, we just said on Twitter, let's try and set something up that's for people like us. And it actually took us a really long time to get it off the ground. This was probably in June. June 2018.
Yeah.
In the last Men's World Cup. And we didn't start until February the next year because we just decided, okay, let's look for some venues that show football that we would both feel confident going to watch football in. And turns out they don't exist. So if anyone listening knows of any places which are not like heavily involved, revolving around alcohol, that have like, you know, variety of different foods, it's like decent pricing, it's accessible, hit us up, because at the moment we can't find somewhere that we'd feel comfortable to go and watch football. And we did find a venue in a hotel and they were super welcoming and warm to us. But then they changed ownership. So we had like two events, and we've since then found other projects. But that, you know what, this project with Amara, she's, you know, she's much younger than me, very determined. She was just like, hey, let's just do it. Let's just invite people. We'll book somewhere. We'll just do it ourselves. And that's kind of been the attitude we've had. We've just gone about it. We're not funded. We've just really been relying on favors and like little bits of money been spent by us here and there. But we also just got in touch with people in our network. So we managed to collaborate with Chelsea. We did a really good initiative with their LGBT supporters group. The year before the pandemic.
Yep, 2019. Yeah.
And
during the year of the Women's World Cup. Yeah.
Exactly. And we got out to the Women's World Cup, which is like probably the best thing I've ever done.
Oh, that's awesome. France put on a really great show, and it felt really, you know, like a proper World Cup in a lot of ways that I, having only been to men's World Cups before that, it was great to see actually that some sponsors had stepped up, because the years before that I'd watched it be televised, it never felt like there was the level of budget in even the broadcast, you know, which is my sort of, let's say, area of expertise. I could see the level of investment went up significantly. So that was great to see, and great to see that groups like yours, which are so intentional about setting up safe spaces for people to enjoy the game and be themselves with the game, got a chance to experience that World Cup, because I think it's a good step in the right direction.
It's interesting you mentioned like broadcasting, because one of the sort of systemic barriers that we have noticed is that, I know we've spoken about this as Ellie, but for the listeners, how you know, broadcasting rights, and you know, how I guess broadcasters distribute their licenses is mainly to alcohol venues like pubs and bars. I mean, especially in the UK, I think it's slightly different.
A very good conversation. No, a very good conversation to have. And I think this is something that when you were calling on there, people who know, I think what I would like to ask actually is for broadcasters who hold a lot of financial weight and control, because ultimately they do. I don't mind to stay. I'm happy to die on that sword because I've seen it in the flesh and I've benefited from it, having worked in that side. They actually could help really to change that. Hey,
they
could really help to change that. And I think if you are a broadcaster right now and you're looking for meaningful things that you can do around the inclusion space, I think you start from there. How are we enabling everybody to be able to watch sport and to be able to watch sport in a way that feels aligned with their identity?
Yeah,
there's a brief. There's a brief for everybody working in broadcast.
And who's getting the rights and the licenses? That's something I'd really love to find out. Like whether people know who owns the venues and what the makeup of those people are. But even with the deal that's come through with women's football in England, that Sky Sports are going to show it. I mean, great step, but that's just another round of fixtures now that we're not going to be able to watch. Because
That's an expensive pay TV.
Or, you know, I'm not going to be able to go somewhere that's going to show it. So that's just another barrier that has been put in the way and at the expense. I guess it's not even an expense. How can we grow women's football if we're not growing it for everyone? Mm.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's where, again, broadcast needs to go back to its playbook, right? One of the things I always used to say when I was, you know, had to work hard to make cases for women's sport to be bought as rights and to shown. I always used to say, you know, when men's sports started off, when properties like the Premier League, the NBA, the NFL, properties that are now worth billions, right? Big brands in their own right, outside of just being, you know, a sports that you view. Someone had to back them and build them. And one of the main ways in which they were backed and built was by making them accessible and easy to watch and making them so commonplace in everyone's viewing behavior. And why that approach isn't being taken for women's sport is something that does not sit well with me, because that's an active choice that's being made to say we're going to deliberately ignore a business strategy and an approach we know works for building up a sport and giving it its platform. And the reason we're going to do that is because we do not believe in its potential. That's a truth, you know, and I think it's about time people started to own that and to question themselves as to why, because there's a lot of evidence that's showing that there is a revenue opportunity. There is showing that it does make money, that it does have an audience that want it. So my question is, why aren't we investing in it? What are the real reasons why? And I know that's quite a confrontational question to ask, but I think it's important that we as an industry are honest about the value we hold in women's sport and what we're actually going to do to evidence that.
Yeah, I think we just need to push for more. Like, I mean, I'm cynical but for saying this, and I dare not say it on social media, but the listeners, you now understand a bit more about me, so you can see where I'm coming from, is that I think we have been made to feel grateful for, like, scraps,
little things.
Yeah. And the reality is, like, it's just not good enough. Like, we talk a lot in women's sport about, oh, this is a great step forward. It's not a great step forward if it's going nowhere. It's only going forward if there's actually part of a bigger plan and it's reaching. We've seen, for example, this TV deal. BT Sport had a deal. And what difference did that really make? So is it really a step forward? I mean, I'm being cynical.
You're not being cynical, and that's why I'm saying where is the actual long-term intention and strategy behind actually growing a proper platform and long-term sustainable audience and commercial model for the game? Because it's good to do the deals, but what are they actually laddering up to? So I don't think you're being cynical. I think that's a really pertinent question to ask, and it's interesting. You're not the first person who's come on here to say that women's sport is made to feel grateful. That's definitely a conversation I've had with Maggie Murphy, who I'm sure you've come across as a general manager at Lewis FC. It's a conversation I've had with Beck Smith, who is, of course, executive director at Copper 90 and used to be a professional football player herself. There is a recurring theme that has happened long term, which is that, you know, we go with a begging bowl for women's sport, and whatever gets put into that begging bowl, we take forward as a gospel. And I think, you know, as you say, we do need to demand more because we deserve more. And I think, you know, Ambi Wambach, who's a hero of mine growing up, is a great female US soccer player. She put it really well. We need to demand the ball because we know we can play and we know that we've got a great product here. So we need to be unapologetic in asking for that. And I would 100% echo that. And I think it's good to see these steps, but as you say, what are they actually going to do?
Yeah, and I think that's why, like, Nutmegs and a lot of people I admire working in women's sport are just doing their own things because we can't wait around to be given bare minimum from the powers that be, for lack of a better term. People are just doing their own thing, creating their own spaces, creating their own initiatives. And do you know what? I think we'll look back with shame to know that that's what's had to happen to achieve the change that we want to see. Yeah. But I think that's the reality. We do need the sort of grassroots, independent work that's being done. Even like this podcast, for example, is any. Look how you're getting your, you know, you just came in to do the work for you and for other people. And there's so many people in this space who are doing similar things.
Yeah.
And we really need to be grateful and recognize the impact that will have on others.
Thank you. That's incredibly kind of you to say. And the reason why I started it as well was, you know, my own sort of confrontation for myself that I was saying there. I was busy asking a lot of employers I worked with, brands I worked with, to do this with me, and they kept saying no. And then after a while, I say to myself, gosh, if you really truly believe in this, Lisely, why wouldn't you build it to show them how successful and impactful it can be? Because that's how much you believe in it, right? You either do or you don't. And that's just my view. I'm not saying that everybody has to do that. And I was lucky that I was in a position that I could do it financially. But for me, it meant so much that I actually, you know, put my money where my mouth was, which was saying this could work. This deserves a platform. Women deserve a space to be represented and to be visible and to actually go ahead and show people that it can work. So I think the ownership bit as well around why women are setting up these grassroots projects that you're talking about that are making a good impact and difference is the fact that, you know, we are going to have to do a lot ourselves to get it to the right place. And as you say, hopefully in doing that, help get people to realize actually we should, you know, the big multinationals, the big wealthy owners of sport to start to take more responsibility themselves.
Yeah, I completely agree. And thank God for people like you and other people who are doing this in this space, because we need to push for more. And, you know, sometimes we've got to take things into our own hands, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And I'm just going back there because I made you go off on a tangent, but I wanted to talk about Nutmegs because it is a project that has actually inspired my want to create spaces like In Her Corner. So that's why I wanted to talk about it, because for me, it seemed like it was inspired from obviously that project at Kick It Out, where you got to empower and get young people involved in having their claim in the game. And another project that you've done, and I'm hoping this is one you're going to choose as has given you a good career life learning that I'd love to chat about, just in terms of that visibility and that normalization of women's sport and celebration of women's sport, is a film that you've and a book that you've produced called Just Watch Me Play. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you've learned from the process of developing that? Because I think it's important now that we're, you know, calling on people to go and create spaces and initiatives to promote women's football. Do you want to talk through that?
Yeah, so actually it goes back to my time at Kick It Out again. During the time when I was doing my internship, I met Simone Stewart, who at the time was an intern as well. She just did a couple of days working with us.
Yeah.
And she lives in Wolverhampton. She's gone on to work for the BBC, BBC Sport, doing some amazing work. She's now an award-winning producer. We just became friends. We hit it off. Like, see another black woman work in this space, wanted to support her. We've both supported each other throughout our careers. And she's working for BBC Sport in Manchester. And I remember she sent me a message on WhatsApp in 2017. And I think it was something along the lines of, like, I had a dream that we wrote a children's book together. Let's write one. Uh-huh. And she's a very determined person, and she goes Love after it. What she wants. And we just explored it from that day. We thought it was like 2 years ago. Turns out it was like all the way in 2017. So we just got together. We wrote down what we wanted to be about. We aligned really well with like our ideas and our experiences. So it basically explores the journey of a young black girl who loves football. She's 8 years old. She moves to a new town, None of her friends she meets at school are girls play football. There's no school football team in her area or at her school. And she basically faces a lot of challenges from teachers, from boys in her school who tell her that she can't play football and like to go and play dress up with her friends, basically.
And
she faces a whole heap of barriers along the way, but she's got this amazing relationship with her dad who supports and encourages her. So we also have like a running theme of the book, which is about how... Yeah, her dad is there with his, you know, his preaching. He's a bit based on my dad and Simone's dad. And he encourages her. So it's showing a positive relationship between, black fathers and their daughters as well.
Yeah.
So it's a really important story that we wanted to bring to life. So we wrote it. We must have finished it in 2018. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, obviously it's a children's book, so it's not like a whole, like, anthology. It's not that long. Yeah. But it's significant. But we had an agent, we went out to publishers, and they basically loved the book, and the agent loved the book as well. But publishers said that they didn't think that women's sport had its time yet. Mm. So it wasn't like the right moment to invest and publish in the book. And one of the things this project is
the number of times I've heard that.
I know.
Oh my.
Do you know what? The project has taught me a lot of things. It's taught me about the joy that comes from collaborating with like another woman who just brings so many different things to the table, but that you align with so well.
Yeah.
Like, just working together on something and like birthing something, it's just been really nice to do that with a friend. But the other thing is like not to give up, because we could have easily just turned around and been like, okay, we're going to take these experts' words for it and just leave the book, but we'd already invested in it, and we saw the book as, you know, a means to get our message out there, which was to inspire more young girls of color to play football and to give them that visibility. We just felt that if we go out to, you know, young girls who already read in, you know, high amounts, then we'll be able to reach that audience. So we didn't give up. We've still been working away. Simone is like I said, amazingly determined woman. She last year decided that she was going to try and make like a short film based on the book.
Yeah.
So she got, I don't even know how she did it. She's amazing. I think she's so determined, she convinced everyone. But she just got a whole group of people together to work with her on it. And it was during the lockdown. So unfortunately, like I wasn't able to go to Wolverhampton. I think I was in tier something and they weren't or something like that.
Yeah.
But she got some people to volunteer their time to shoot this amazing 11-minute film. Yeah. And it depicts the first sort of three chapters more or less of the book. Because we wanted to use this as an opportunity to show the story so that we'd get support when we do eventually publish the book. Yeah. But also because of the conversations that have been happening in England around like the lack of diversity in the women's football team, we really wanted to give an opportunity to reignite that conversation and to provide a bit of a solution to get more girls interested in football.
Definitely.
So it's been really well received. We launched it this week. The feedback has just been beautiful, and we're just more determined than ever. We're going to see if we can, you know, try again to get some publishing support. Yeah. And then if not, we're self-publishing in time for next year's Euros. So it will come one way or another.
Yeah, no, I'm super excited, and having had a chance to watch that 11-minute, sort of summary of the three chapters, I really loved it, and I was really moved by it. And there was two particular things that stood out to me from it as a film, but also as the book, as if you've explained it to me. It was the positive representation of a Black father and his role in cultivating and encouraging his little girl's love and determination to play football despite barriers put in front of her. I think there's such a valuable learning there for Black communities, you know, which I grew up in, particularly Black African communities, around encouraging girls to not just watch football, but also to play it and to feel it, that it's a space that they can be confident in and play and not be silenced or pushed out of it because, you know, they, quote, don't belong there, need to be dressing up or playing dolls. I think that's something that, within Black African culture, certainly I've experienced and I need to see a lot better advocacy from within our own community for young girls and giving them access and not gatekeeping them away from the game.
Yeah, and we also think that, you know, both of, you know, our fathers have had a really big impact on our interest in sport.
Yeah.
And we know that, like, the representation of, like, Black dads is really poor in terms of like the stereotypes that go along with it. So, and we know that there's a role that, you know, ultimately dads do have to play in pushing girls to play sport. And, you know, the other thing that's really important about the story, and it, you know, emerges through their relationship as a father and daughter, is that the importance of Cleo's culture, like Cleo's a real character. Like, she's very proud of her like West Indian heritage. She uses that to push herself through, even though she is different. And she flourishes as a result of that. So it's not something that holds you back in life. It's like your difference is something that you embrace.
Being empowered by her difference and really using it to get herself to live her dream and her love for sport. And I think what you say there about dads is so true. I mean, my dad, you know, had three girls, bless him, and he loved to share sport with us. You know, he took us to as many things as possible. I mean, my first ever live sports event that I got to do, which was just, you know, a dream come true, was I got to go and watch that iconic World Cup final in South Africa, in rugby. You know, that was my first, big sporting outing. And that stayed with me, and that really got me to love sport. And I remember he would seek out women's football for me. So I, from a very young age, I'm a bit of an anomaly. I got to see women's football because he showed me Mia Hamm, and he's like, she's awesome. You know, don't you want to go and play football and be as good as someone like that? And Abby Wambach. And so I had this really great opportunity through my father, who loved sport, passing that love down and giving us chances to see role models that we could then relate to and play sport through, not just, you know, the great male athletes, obviously at that time when I was growing up in the 90s, but also the great female athletes. And I'm forever grateful to him for that, because probably without that, and probably without your dads, you and Simone and obviously Cleo in the story, that belief and that drive and that passion wouldn't be there.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I think that's a story that's often forgotten about. And, you know, dads are our target audience for the book, for buying the book. It was important for us to reflect that. And I'm glad you love the film. We've had a really good response, and we just hope that people support it when it comes out. And, you know, even if it doesn't, we'll push. Like, we want to create educational activities. We've had requests from teachers already to use it in schools. So it's about having a bigger impact than just, oh, everyone's going to read it and buy it. It's about the message and what the message we hope to achieve for it.
Definitely, it's having conviction in your project and believing in its purpose and impact. I think that's such a good, valuable lesson from your experience there. But I am sure it'll be a hit. You know, I think all things say decide. I think it'll be a hit. And just sort of to finish off, because I am aware I've taken a lot of your time and your efforts and I've picked a lot of your brains. But something I'm really curious about is, you know, you've got all these great spaces that you occupy and really good influential work that you're doing to help educate and make people feel empowered about creating more equitable, inclusive spaces. But when you look back, you know, in 20, 30 years time, what is the thing that you would love to kind of have as your legacy? What was it, the thing that you'd love to overhear someone say about you that will make everything that you're going through, those difficulties you described so eloquently, feel like they were all worth it?
You know, I think about this a lot, and I think I want the people that I have, like, done little things or big things to help come through and just do better than me. So I want people to feel like, oh, yeah, because of you, Hayley, I was able to do this. And not in a way that's going to make me feel like I was responsible, but just knowing that, like, something that I've done has, you know, had an impact on another person. Because I think what I try and do is I never, like, spoon-feed people information. I always just try and hold a mirror up to people to show that they are great, or to show them that actually you're worthy, you belong, you deserve to be here. People don't really need me to tell them they're great, they know that they are. It's just sometimes it is removing those barriers or just helping people get over barriers that actually do exist in reality. So that's something I'd be really proud of. And I think seeing more communities and spaces around women's sport which are representative and people, I would love for someone to copy like the Nutmegs model, maybe do a better job than it, maybe to say that I've done this for another sport or I've done this in another country or something like that, so that we know that we've had a knock-on effect, because you can't do this on your own. Like I said, there are people like you and others doing some amazing things independently, but we also are quite collaborative as a community in women's sport, so we also want to see other people be inspired by us to do their own things, right?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think such a fitting contribution of yours. And I think it's something that you're definitely living through your legacy at the moment, Hayley, because I speak to so many people who work in football and outside of sport, and you're so loved and so respected. And I think the reason that you are so, and I know you're probably cringing because you do not like this kind of compliment. I'm just saying, I'm like, oh, she'll be like, stop, Liz Ellie. But no, I want to take a moment to say it. And because, you know, often we don't get a chance to say to each other, but I just want to say that it's so wonderful to have a woman who doesn't just speak about empowering people and creating spaces for them to be their full selves. It's also just awesome that is your purpose, and that is what you're driven by. So I just want to say a massive thank you for occupying those spaces and doing the hard work to help us all be the best and fullest version of ourselves.
Oh, thanks so much, and likewise, see you right back at you.
Thank you. So, thank you so much to everybody for tuning in to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely inspirational Hayley Bennett.